Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We are continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. The topic today, the Millennial Dilemma, the strengths, challenges, the weaknesses of the younger generation in the 21st century era of what many perceive as a American dystopian times. My guest from the Ozark Mountains is Andrew Harvey. Andrew is an internationally renowned religious scholar, author of over 30 books. He is the founder of the Institute of Sacred Activism, which is an international organization dedicated to inspiring people to become more involved in challenging our global crisis and to commit themselves to peace and sustainability. Andrew was born in India, studied at Oxford University, and taught at Oxford. He taught at Cornell University, California Institute of Integral Studies, and other institutions over the years. He's perhaps best known for having explored all the different religions in depth, particularly Buddhism and Christianity, Hinduism and Sufism, and interpreting them in a passionate manner that preserves their meaning and significance for our postmodern times. He's received many awards for his work, including the Benjamin Franklin Award. His book is The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, one of his latest ones, which won the Nautilus Silver Award for Social Change. His most recent is Return to Joy with Carolyn Baker. His website is andrewharvey.net. Nice to have you back with us, Andrew.
Gary, thank you so much. And what an important subject to be plunging into together, the subject of what the millennials need now to face and to how they need to go forward, because on their shoulders are going to fall the terrible consequences of the catastrophe that we're now living in. And unless they truly wake up from their sleep and start reacting in an organized and spiritually profound way, they're going to be swept away by this tremendous dark hurricane.
I'm glad you started there, because this is going to be a continuation of one of our previous conversations back at the end of June, where we discussed the conditions and challenges that the younger generations face as we move into a runaway climate change, the collapse of the free market capitalism, a more volatile and warlike planet, massive disassociation between cultures that cannot assimilate easily or at all. We're especially seeing that in much of Europe with the crisis in Sweden and in other countries, and we don't know how to process this information. We also have the worst health in American history. We have more obesity, diabetes, cancers, heart disease, and more younger people, their generation, thinking it's completely normal to have a psychiatric diagnosis. In other words, they're living through multiple pathology images. The pathology of either you are one of the, and these numbers are rather staggering, but they're accurate. More than 62 million people can live as millionaires. Now, we actually only have about 10 million millionaires, but you have about four per family. For two children, a husband and wife, you also have 17.8 million professional class in the United States. Now, you take that with times four, and you're dealing with 100 million Americans who either think they're millionaires because they're able to buy anything, have unlimited credit card usage, go to whatever school they want, like $70,000 close to that amount at New York University, not including your home and your apartment or food. You also can travel anywhere. In fact, I'm seeing this when I see all these apartment buildings that are brand new, over 100 brand new apartment buildings in New York City, just on the west side, just between 72nd Street and 22nd Street. And you're thinking, when you call the number on the building, I just did this Sunday. I went for a walk downtown. And I walked down this old railroad track that they have remodeled to make it into a community park. It's a beautiful place. And as you're walking past all these buildings, and they're brand new. So I was calling, what's an apartment sell for? Well, it's $1 million per bedroom.
God.
So the cheapest you can find, the absolute, and these are, when I say cheap, I'm talking about 600 square foot. That's a loft. $1 million, million two. When you get up to $8 million, you're still only dealing about 2,500 square feet. So the most expensive rents, the most expensive sales prices, and you're dealing with tens of thousands of apartments. So who's taking these apartments? Investors from other countries? And then there was a little restaurant, and this restaurant specialized in beers. That's what they're famous for. Wow. And I looked at the menu, and the average bill was $65.
Good God.
I wanted to see what it was like inside, and it held about 100 people. Every table was taken, and each table had multiple beers, like one person had four or five beers. So who has, who has $500 to spend just casually out drinking with friends in one night, and you're going to do this three or four nights a week? Who has, and one of the menus they had was a sandwich made out of the meat of a pig's head. And it was $80. Who has $80 for a pig's head sandwich and also a beer at $60? And you start to realize it's the children, the millennials of those 10 million millionaires. So if you get the daughter and sister, you're dealing with 20 million there. And then the professional class, lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, accountants, architects, scientists, people who make between 100,000 to maybe 700,000 a year, but they're living like they're millionaires, and they're not. They're in debt up to their eyeballs. They've mortgaged their homes, and yet their kids demand to be privileged. They don't want to work. They want private tutors in schools. So on the one hand, you have the largest generation in American history having money and access to credit and someone else paying the bills. And if they're a professional class, their tuition is paid by their parents under guarantees. If they're the wealthiest class, the real millionaires, they pay it off and there's no debt at all.
Wow.
Now, here's what a person's facing as a millennial. You're dealing now with at least 40 million. That's a huge number, 40 million millennials who have enough money. They can go anywhere, do anything, buy anything. Some will pay cash for it. Others will be in debt, or someone else will be in debt for them. They're never in debt themselves. And then you have the diseases. You have the disconnect with the environment, within global warming and its consequences.
Absolutely.
You have a body politic completely dystopian and corrupt by oligarchs in the deep state and those figureheads they put in front of them, the laughing fools that we call politicians, and the technocratic best and brightest from the Ivy League schools who are smarter than the politicians they serve, and they stay there as long as it's beneficial. So they're the ones filling up those 400,000 jobs in the military defense contracting segment. And then you have the media bias, so they never know if what they're reading or seeing or hearing is legitimate, honest, or accurate. I give you this as a large overview.
Oh, my God, it's so absolutely accurate. It's very scary. But one of the things we haven't mentioned, and I think this is really important, and I know you believe this really to be important, is the question, what are the real values of the millennials? What are they prepared to suffer for? What are they prepared to stand in resistance to? What are they prepared to be outraged by? This is a question that I'm still not able to answer. I do know some millennials who have risen above the narcissism of their class and who've risen above the entitlement and the self-absorption and the endless twittering and tweeting. But there are still no clear lines to that question emerging from that generation, and that's a scary thing when you consider the depth of the crises that we're meeting.
Yes. You're absolutely right. I want to go a little further with this. And have you spent some specific examples, because that's one of the things you do so well. You give us examples to tie in a larger construct with specifics. You look at the manual labor that was enjoyable generations ago. Even for elite and scholars, it was part of the transition we went through. We all went through our period where we had to put in our time, our effort, our scholarship, our originality. knowing that it would be a period of time before we would be recognized for our efforts and therefore have a chance to evolve and rather slow-paced change. Today, right. Everything is instantaneous and there is no real scholarship. We also were part of building up the free market capitalism, even though some of us were ethical and looked at the commons and looked at the good and looked at socialism for those who needed that. Today, there is no real understanding of what price you pay for all the capitalism that we have and how do you deal with that? An even more volatile and warlike planet today, and which will increase the world's resources. And that means that the machine could run short. The machine for water, for food. We're going to have food shortages because it's already known. This has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with the sun. It has to do with heat. It has to do with too much rain in some places and too little in other places. That's what really caused the conflict in Syria.
Right.
Was they had the worst famine in their history.
Right.
We've had in the United States two once in 500-year events happened in the last 6 months.
Wow.
So we also are looking at the fact that people don't like manual labor today. They don't like scholarship today. And in general, the average young adult today would be incapable of surviving on their own in the event of that all the necessities of modern living were not available, readily available and purchasable. And a lot of young adults are truly the victims of the older generation's quest for luxury and easement. So overall, I would like for you to take us on a journey of what you see the millennials are doing that benefits them in the society and what they're not doing. And we have to distinguish between those millennials that are coming from a middle-class working or poor background that have none of the advantages of the other and have to struggle for everything, and those millennials who are coming from an entitled background where they do not have to do anything except show up and be rewarded. So the millennials must be separated by their circumstances, their ethnicity, their class position. The form is yours. Take your time.
Well, Gary, I think, first of all, thank you for your analysis. It was very frightening and very sobering and very clear and very accurate. I don't have much hope for the entitled millennial class, I have to say. I see them as being completely invaded by the false values and hysterias of a consumer culture, massively entitled, deeply narcissistic, and very bizarrely apathetic in the face of this horrific crisis that they are themselves reaping rewards from. What I do see is that in the middle classes and in the working classes, there is a very clear, strong, still fragile, but profoundly active group of millennials who have woken up to the fact that we're in a potentially terminal state of civilization. I see that in the Black Lives Matter movement. A lot of very clean, clear, passionate thinking and acting coming out of that. I see it in the resistance movement, the women resistance movement, where a lot of young millennial women finally woke up to the fact that the rights of feminism have been very, very difficultly secured and need now to be secured even faster in a time where they're being threatened so abjectly by the Republicans. I see that in tremendously valuable contributions being made in small groups that are arising to pray together, to come together, to give each other spiritual support, to live simply together and to start serving their communities. There are communities like this all over the country. These millennials are really saying to me three things. The first thing that they're saying to me is, we are completely disillusioned with the baby boomer generation. We've seen through their lies, their fantasies of comfort, their addictions, their cheerfulness, their fake cheerfulness, their Oprah-light spirituality. We are sick of them and we despise them. That's the first thing that they're saying to me, because they feel completely betrayed, as they should. The second thing that they're saying to me is that none of the conventional spiritual solutions work for them, because they see too clearly how abjectly all of the religions have been taken over by dogma, by fundamentalism, by preening about their own revelations, and that this is causing massive division in the world. But they're not prepared to give up the spiritual, but they're not in any way attracted by the conventional religious solutions. The third thing that they say to me, and this is what gives me great hope, I'm 65 now, and I've been working on this for 20 years. The third thing they say to me is that the vision that I and others are offering of sacred activism, of an activism that is grounded in deep spiritual truth and also enacted with deep spiritual truth, with a commitment to nonviolence, but very clean and fierce and resistant, that this really is the only possible solution now. And they're tired of any smaller solutions. They're going for that. They're going for a worldwide resistance movement of love in action. There's still a few of them. They're not many of them, but they are very, very sobered up, wised up, and extremely awake, perhaps the most awake group of people on the planet. So that's the scene that I see, a massive dysfunction in the great majority of millennials who are really fundamentally fodder for the death machine and deeply, secretly depressed without any real hold on their depression, and these beings who are emerging in the biggest evolutionary crisis in history, fully aware sometimes, very often, of the extent of the crisis and the enormous challenge of it, and willing to put their own young lives on the line to do something amazing. And that is really the hope for the future. They are the hope. And we must do everything we can to support them and to encourage them. And as an elder, I try to offer really three things to them. I offer, first of all, my recognition of the horror of the situation that they're in. I think it's very important for them to see and know that there are adults who are not in the American pipe dream and who will acknowledge the horror of what's happening. The second thing I offer them is really the experience of my own mystical journey and my coming to understand that you can face a time like this only really if you're profoundly rooted in the depth of your true self through sacred practice, through whatever practice truly, truly can help you. And I can share those practices with people, and I'm doing so. And the third thing that I can help them with is with the mobilization and organization of themselves as they come together to do the great work of trying to have a human future. And that's why my work on sacred activism is, I think, helpful amongst others now, because the fundamental things that are needed for this young group of millennials is a vision of how to come together grounded in spiritual principles and how to work together nonviolently and how to do shadow work together so as to avoid being sabotaged by the exploding shadows everywhere of a culture in decline, and how to mobilize in such a way that they excite and enthuse and invigorate others instead of blaming or shaming or depressing others, because it's far too late a situation to just load people with horrifying blame. It's time now to give an authentic vision of a new life, how to live that life so as to inspire others. This is really what an elder can do, and this is what I'm trying to do. So I hope that that is a
That's a good overview. Answer. Yes, it is. Thank you for that. Andrew, let's pull back a little further, because
please.
I'm very inspired by the rejuvenation of those millennials who saw how corrupt our system was, saw how
yes.
vile the body politic had become, the fetidness of the corporate Clinton, Blue Dog Democrat liberal, and the fascistic,
right.
completely unapologetic conservative Republican. And therefore, they went for
Doberman,
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And with Bernie Sanders, they were hearing about student debt forgiving.
Exactly.
Forgivable. They were also hearing about universal health care. And they were hearing about challenging Wall Street. They had at least eight good policy positions that Sanders supported, and those were terrific. On the
they
other
were.
Side—
They were very important. It was a major blast of truth.
The other side of it was, is to have the elders come forward and say, okay, But remember, Bernie Sanders is still a neocon. He is a hawk. He supports the military-industrial complex. He supports Saudi Arabia. He supports the invasion of Libya and Syria regime change.
Right.
He was not caustic or critical of the coup that Hillary Clinton engineered in Honduras, nor the Newland, who was the person in the State Department, who's married to Kagan, the top neocon in the United States, and the disaster that would be. He is non-critical of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. So when you look at all these other factors that are also important, then you have one of these good and not good positions. But at least on the other side, there was not good anywhere. He at least had the courage to have it. Now, here's the idea. Bernie Sanders, instead of fighting the Clinton machine and the Democratic National Convention when he found out, which he did, that he was being deprived of the nomination and the media was not covering him honestly. He would have 20,000 people and she would have 300 people. She would get the media. He wouldn't.
Right.
Instead, he said, I'm going to fold these people into the Democratic Party. And he encouraged them all to come in and vote for her. And I'm thinking, no, he should have gone independent. He could have still won against Donald Trump. And he'd be president today, and at least half of his agenda would be more humanistic and progressive. Instead, he took the people. Now, to their credit, at least half or more of the millennials who otherwise would have voted for Bernie Sanders chose not to vote for Hillary Clinton. They either voted for Jill Stein or they didn't vote. And so going forward now, I'm hopeful that the millennials will pay attention to the wise men and women, the Barbara Ehrenreichs and the Jill Steins and you and Chris Hedges, Cornel West, who can guide them into you don't need the best of two bads. There's an altogether good.
An independent party, absolutely.
So polls among the different generations reveal that millennials are increasingly becoming more and more pessimistic about their future. They're facing an existential and enormous environmental crisis during their lifetime.
And almost half, yes.
And almost half now don't have a savings account, according to Bloomberg article. 30% don't feel they will manage to pay off their debt and believe the U.S. economy will implode. They're becoming debt slaves, which might actually be a strategy of the elite. And a Gallup poll
absolutely.
A few months ago found that 70% of young Americans favor socialism and a redistribution of wealth, and 30% regard socialism more favorably than capitalism. And they have little faith in the market and the myth of capitalist growth and trickle-down economics. And the progress as a solution to lessen their dire view of the future, there are no solutions where they're at now. And these are all signs of a revolution on the horizon if any actual leadership can emerge. And, of course, the oligarchs have only themselves to blame. Nevertheless, they seemingly intuit the socioeconomic problems of the current paradigm of corporate and political governance than the older generation, which is why cooperation and community seem to be an esteemed value to millennials, which is almost avant-garde today. But will you please speak about the lack of leaders emerging among young adults that could mobilize and energize them to challenge the status quo? And when I think back to the youth leaders of the Students for Democratic Society and the Weathermen and the Black Panthers, like Rabbi Michael Lerner and Mark Rudd and Angela Davis and Tom Hayden and Bobby Seale and Stokely Carmichael, who I knew personally, Jerry Rubin was a close friend, they were all in their 20s, yet brilliant minds and with extraordinary passion and courage. But I don't see that among most young adults today, except for a few in the environment and food movements. So stepping up to take on the burden of leadership, give us your in-depth thoughts.
Well, I think you've hit on something very crucial. I think that there's a tremendous confusion in the millennials that I talk to about what leadership is. There seem to be really two camps. On the one hand, there's the camp that you saw very frivolously enacting itself, I think, in the Occupy movement, the camp that says we should not have leaders, we should listen to everybody, we should be ecumenical and all-embracing. And there's a truth in that, and there's a nobility in that. But when you're facing the kinds of forces that we're facing, that is an indulgence. It's a luxury that we simply cannot afford. The other camp is much smaller, but that camp is the realistic camp that says there has to be a group of passionate, brave, articulate, deeply trained, profoundly spiritual and profoundly active people who are willing to take a leadership position and who are willing to craft a message which can bring everybody together on certain absolutely essential issues, such as healthcare, such as free education, such as the ending of nuclear weapons, such as the real rehaul of Washington, such as a coherent climate policy. And these are the ones that I respect, because it's really essential that millennials don't become fuzzy-minded and woolly-hearted about leadership and realize that we're in an extreme situation which is going to demand greater clarity, greater discipline, greater focus, greater organization, greater, deeper inner work and braver outer work than any that we've ever faced in our history.
Very insightful. Thank you on that. I remember back in the early 1970, I put the word out that I would be willing to invite young people, idealistic, to come up to the Fertiller Farm, the first teaching organic farm in New York State, and the second one to Rodell down in Emmaus, Pennsylvania, but his really wasn't a teaching one. And for 15 years, every summer, I would have courses all summer, and if you came to learn about gardening and beekeeping, conservation of the soil, veganism, it was free. It was a public service. And we were flooded. We were flooded. We would have on a Saturday sometimes 500 people.
They would come for that.
And I would make them all a giant meal. I'd make like a 20-course meal. And people would come and they would have a great time and they would learn. Now, here's what I'm finding now. If you read the journal, the Society for Personality and Social Psychology, they concluded that millennials are the most narcissistic generation in history.
That's wealthy or not wealthy. No, they
if
are.
If we accept that narcissism is learned, it's a behavioral trait, then it begs the question whether or not the real responsibility lies not with the millennials themselves, but the older generation's creation of social media and the entertainment industry and this cult of self and even reality TV. So the dysfunction of the boomers should be attributable in no small measure to the younger generation's end result of being somewhat socially dysfunctional. Humanistically void.
I hear you.
So now you couldn't get 15 young people coming up to do any work because of work. Man, I ain't going to work. Get my hands in the soil. I don't want to get my hands in the soil. You know, but I'm here, so give me a gift and make me the winner. So do you see this phenomenon going on?
Oh, completely. I think that the baby boomers' chief achievement was an institutionalized orgy of narcissism on every conceivable level in our culture. And this orgy conscripted the young from birth to it and infected them with its appalling lack of values on every level. It infected them with its lack of any cultural depth, its frivolity, its self-absorption, its obsession with technology, and they've become complete victims of the baby boomer hubris, which is now exploding in ashes and shards everywhere. And this is tragic. And what's more tragic is that they, except for the group that I've described, is that they don't seem to recognize it. They don't seem to understand just at what a loss they actually are, because they see their privilege, their entitlement working, their gewgaws, their iPhones, their money, but they don't see that the whole situation is a complete house of cards about to collapse. They just don't get it. They are trapped. And this is extremely sad and extremely dispiriting, because it's like watching a whole generation being funneled into an abattoir, but going there, clicking their iPhones and checking their social profiles.
On Sunday, when I went for this about a mile and a half walk on this High Line, which is just an old railroad track, elevated and beautifully landscaped, I was struck by how many younger people were on their phones sitting there, not looking at this beautiful scenery, the wildflowers and trees and shrubs, and looking out over the city from there. They were all immersed. And then later in the day, I went to two museums. I went to the old Andrew Carnegie original home up on 90th and 5th Avenue, and then a few blocks down. A few blocks down on 79th and 5th Avenue, you had the Vanderbilt home. And I was impressed by the architecture, the mastery.
The grandeur, yes.
And I'm looking, and they also had Klink's, you know, a great photograph, paintings in there. And once again, the people who were there, the younger people, were not looking at the artwork. They weren't looking at the fact that we don't do that kind of flooring anymore, that molding on the ceiling anymore. You know, it was a gift to see this architecture. Nobody was paying attention to it. The older people were. The younger people weren't. So that brings me to this idea.
But you're talking about a complete annihilation of cultural depth. That's the terrible thing of this culture. This is the terrible, terrible hollowness at the core of everything. When you destroy attention, when you destroy through distraction any kind of deep, sacred attention, any attention to a painting or to a poem, any way of really exploring in depth a thought, then what you have is what you have in the millennials, a group of endlessly distracted, self-absorbed, narcissistic people trapped in their devices, trapped in their technological devices, unable to appreciate a true concerto by Mozart, unable to dive into the depths of the background of a Velazquez, unable to really savor the wisdom of the past in a mystical text. And this means that all of the powers and forces of truth and beauty that have over millennia informed and infused and inspired civilization are simply not able to get through to them.
Are you familiar with the social philosopher Morris Berman?
I've heard of Morris Berman. I haven't actually read him.
Okay, I read his book, The Twilight of American Culture, and basically it was a very prophetic examination, although very caustic, similar to Montaigne in some respects and Immanuel Kant and Nietzsche, about the decline of Western civilization. And it is pessimistic, because Berman felt there is little society can do anymore to arrest the onset of corporate mass media culture. And that what is needed is a new kind of new monistic individual, as he called them, and who would preserve the literacy, philosophical, and historical treasures of our civilization, very much like the Irish monks on the Isle of Anoma.
Absolutely, and don't you feel that this is what your life has been about? I do feel that that image is very crucial to me as I try to do the work I do, but really in doing Noah's Ark Irish Celtic work, aren't we?
Yes, because we either descend into the Dark Age, the New Dark Age, or we transform our focus to understanding we are connected to life and look at the other pieces of the puzzle of which we are one. And I'm not arguing for a celibate monasticism of any kind, rather I'm thinking about people challenging the embodiment of all that is materialistic and looking instead at the great works of classical literature and history and psychology and philosophy and mysticism. And that is what I believe will separate out the person who, when speaking to them, may come from Harvard, may have a 4-point average, and may have graduated magna cum laude, but is a functional illiterate. They've dumbed down so much that there is no rational or integral mind behind that. So therefore, you can have no conversation of any depth, because they've never been encouraged to go deep into anything. Your thoughts?
And never given the tools. You can be encouraged to go deep, but if you haven't been given the tools, if you haven't been instructed in how to sit silently and live in silence and listen to your thoughts and open to the magical time of a string quartet, or really devote 10 minutes to understanding a line in George Herbert or in Rumi, or to really concentrate on a complex passage in a major book that is trying to help you understand the depth of what's going on, for example, in the Middle East. If you've never been given the tools, you've never been taught how to, you've never been had revealed to you the splendor of what lies in those forms of concentration, you truly are at the most helpless loss in a culture like ours. You're really just fodder for the endless publicity machine of the oligarchy.
I fully appreciate and understand that, but most people don't, because they don't know who the oligarchy is, and sometimes it's their own parents. When you realize how many of their parents are captains of industry, but you see they don't see them in the workplace. They don't see them in those board meetings and buying companies just to load the company up in an equity partnership with debt and take all the profits for themselves as consulting fees and management fees, and then let the company rot or bankrupt it. That's what's happening right now. And I'm concerned about that. But anyhow, I do see positive signs that our younger adults are becoming less materialistic than their parents and grandparents.
Now, this and many is from, of them, too, are moving. I've heard from my friends in organic farming in Connecticut. I have friends who are really serious about establishing a whole group of interlinked organic farms, and they're telling me that they find a lot of millennials really anxious to get out of the cities and to start living a holistic lifestyle, really committed to it, too. Is not happening in the baby boomers, who still seem to imagine that Chardonnay will flow forever. But well, particular group of millennials are becoming aware that they need not only to get out of the system, but to start building an alternative system.
I see that myself, and it's not a large amount, but it's happening.
When I look at the Library of Economics, the commune movement of the 60s, it's not at all fairy dancing and hugging and kissing and smoking pot. It's very serious, this particular movement, because they realize, the guys who are turning up, that this is about survival in the collapse of industrial civilization. They know that. And so they're building it with a lot of rigor and rugged determination, which I think is admirable and amazing, and I'm so proud of them, because that they may very well be members of the remnant that survives what is about to unfold. So the millennials turning up to do organic farming and to do it with real knowledge and real application and in an interconnected way with other millennials, they may very well be forming the nuclei of the survival of the remnant that will, let's hope, be there to take humanity forward.
I see the remnants being from those parents who taught them to stay grounded.
Yes.
That you're entitled to nothing that you do not earn. You must, if it's respect you want, if it's love you want, if it's peace you want, if it's embracing passion you want, show that you deserve it. Don't just expect it, because then you don't master what it means to give in return. You're just absorbing everything like a sponge. And I also see a lot of millennials are saying, no, I don't want to buy a house, let alone a McMansion. And they don't buy as much stuff as earlier generations, largely because they don't have the money or home to pile it in. Instead of buying stuff, they prefer to buy experiences. Even clothing and fashion is becoming less popular among them. And sports like boating, golf, and hunting are way down on their list. They drive and travel less often and for shorter distances. And they, instead of camping, is cool again.
That's fascinating.
So it's taking time to work on a farm, as you mentioned. They are far more conscious about healthy foods. Since you are rather closely associated with many millennials, such as Adam Bucco and the new monistic movement among the younger generation, how might these values, albeit largely due to socioeconomic constraints, actually manifest as a new philosophy or spirituality for this generation?
Well, I think you mentioned somebody who is really not only a close and beloved friend, but someone who is really a mentor and a teacher, although he's younger than I am. I look to Adam for so many things. And one of the things that Adam has taught me, really made very clear to me, something that I knew intellectually, but that I didn't really appreciate at a visceral depth until I came to know Adam, is that what's required now isn't a new technique of resistance. What's required now is to live a life of radical and rugged simplicity in harmony with deep spiritual principles and with nature, a return, if you like, to an indigenous ground lit up by the spirit that helps people rediscover the joys of simple life, the joys of living together, the joys of sacred friendship, the joys of bringing up your family in a sane and tender environment, the joys of living with animals, the joys of living in a natural world that you tend. And that this is really the task that Adam has set himself in with others, creating the new monastic order, because this order is about inviting young people to live simply, either in town or in the country, to sustain each other and to really evolve a new way of relating as a tremendous sign that a new culture is possible, a new consciousness can be incarnated, a new world that isn't selfish, that isn't absolutely grounded in narcissistic power, a new world can be created. So these people who are following Adam and who are plunging into the new monastic order and who are really coming together in organic farms, these millennials are doing some heroic and extremely important work, and I salute them. I think it's something that we don't hear enough of, we're not exposed to enough. It's still fragile, it's still not particularly well organized, but the fact is that it's growing, and that's very important.
I would agree. When you look at the people who I see in farmers' markets, I'm seeing more originality, more unique booths. For example, I just saw one at a farmers' market that had a gigantic a glass bottle, but it was beautifully shaped. It was shaped in the size of a pear. And then they had like a floating blueberries, apples, strawberries, and raspberries, and with distilled water, and it was $5 a drink, and people were lined up to get it. And I'm thinking, wow, that it was the design of it. It was a young guy. And then one booth over, they had homemade brittle, but not made with sugar, made with raw honey.
Amazing.
Lined up. And another one had, for $8, they would sell you these long bags of popcorn with different flavors. Now, all these things had something in common. There were over 200 booths. They were younger people who chose not to make it in the regular world. As one guy, I was talking to him for hours, one guy said he graduated from college and he didn't want to go into a 9-to-5 job in a cubicle because he saw what it did to his dad and underachieving life, not success, but life, being so tired and emotionally drained when you get home from compartmentalizing your life. Then in effect, you self-neuter. You neuter your creativity, you neuter your interest, you neuter your passion. And so you just kind of go through these robotic rituals of, well, it's Tuesday, we'll watch television, watch this program, eat this food. And he said he saw this and it scared him. So now he has a booth that sells dried organic animal food. And I looked at his packaging. It was really original. His booth was really hip-looking. And there was a long line of people who wanted it. And he was selling these for about $12 a little bag. I'm saying it was about maybe a half a pound maximum. So I said, how are you doing? He said, we're doing well. I said, how much do you make on a Saturday? And it's only open Saturdays. And he said, well, we'll make anywhere from $700 to $2,000.
Wow.
That's terrific.
And it's terrific.
So what you're seeing, one person had bonsai. Now, when was the last time you saw a booth with nothing but bonsai?
Yes.
No, you don't
that
see
is
it.
Absolutely true. There's a riot of creativity. I was in Maine about a month and a half ago, staying in a place called Blue Hill with great friends, and went to the local market and was completely dazzled by the range of cheeses, by the range of bonsai, by the range of sweets, by the range of breads. There was such a sense of festivity. So it seems that in the middle of all of this ferocious collapse, there are people rediscovering the personal, individual creativity that comes from really devoting yourself to a craft. This is astonishing. I have another friend who is in his early 20s and who is a master woodworker and who hates the consumerist cookie-cutter world and who has really found a way to make these extremely beautiful wooden pens and wooden bowls and earn a simple living from it. And it gives him tremendous joy, and it gives tremendous joy to those who can buy these things and can live with these things. He's keeping almost single-handedly a tradition of English craftsmanship that he was brought up in alive, and this is very moving. And there are many millennials who are doing similar things because they realize that it's doing something like this that enables them to preserve their souls, to preserve their dignity, to preserve their creativity. They've woken up to how hard it is in a flatland world to stay inspired, and they're prepared to give up the superficial lures of consumerism to live in a way that gives them joy. And this is extremely important for now, but it's also a tremendously inspiring sign for the future.
Take it one step further. What role do you see the older generation playing? I believe that all the older generation should step out of the way. I believe that we should not have any more Bernie Sanders or Donald Trumps or Barack Obamas or Hillary Clintons. I believe that we should have younger people who've had experience, have the mastery of issues, are coming with humanistic and spiritual values, and all the older people who are the wise men and women are there as counsel to them.
I think that's exactly the right model. I think, well, when I was in France recently, about 3 weeks ago, I was very, very impressed by the atmosphere that was coming in with Macron. He's, after all, in his late 30s. I think he's 39. And he is handsome and vital and vibrant and passionate about certain important issues. And he's also a leader, and he's also able to mobilize the enthusiasm so far of the young. So there are signs that there are leaders out there who are able to appear at a much earlier age and with a great deal of flair and exuberance and authority. Macron is one. And what we need in the American scene is four amazing young men and four amazing young women to emerge in their 30s and 40s and really lay out a coherent, radical, liberal, revolutionary structure that gets back to nature, that overcomes our addiction to fossil fuel, and bring in a new movement. And the elders should be the advisors to that movement, sharing their experience. But these are the ones who should lead that movement. And I'm praying for their emergence soon, because we desperately need them.
Give us your idea of the role of the right now, the people who've been pushed to the sidelines, those progressives who have been alienated, like Chris Hedges and Glenn Ford and Ellie Bailey, Bruce Dixon from the Black Agenda Report, and others, Robert Perry, John Pilger, because of their positions, because they were no longer willing to tolerate what was being done in the name of liberalism, because that whole movement had been captured.
Yes, and so people bankrupted. Yes.
And so tell us what you see there of the old institutions, both conservative and liberal, being replaced.
Well, I think that when you mention a group such as you've just mentioned, and you mention to me a sacred name, Chris Hedges, you're really talking about people who have seen through the illusions, both liberal and conservative, of a fundamentally addicted capitalist culture. And in Chris Hedges' case, you have a prophetic grandeur of mind and soul and a terrible clarity and a willingness to say the unspeakable and to face the unspeakable. So it seems to me that these beings who have earned the right to be listened to and have won through to such a searing and morally profound clarity are the beings, amongst the beings, that the young leaders need to have around them to be counseled by, because they're going to be operating in a situation that is even more entangled and chaotic and diabolically violent than the one that we are in, and with all kinds of potential temptations and sabotages that will be sent against them, not only by the dark forces of the universe, but also by the very clever forces of power that want to hold on to power. So they're going to need the burnt seers to help them.
Final question for you. A Pew Research survey shows that those between 18 and 29 years old are the least religious group, and fewer millennials belong to any particular faith than older people do today, and they're less likely to be affiliated than their parents and grandparents' generations when they were young, and 25% of all millennials don't embrace any faith, and many don't consider religion or even spiritual practices or basic morality as important. And it's also the most atheistic generation in U.S. history so far. Nevertheless, I observe a deep thirst among millennials for something meaningful in their lives that can be regarded as spiritual. They do hold shared ethics. They could find common ground in the religious faith. So the question is, what do you observe as the spiritual aspirations of a younger adult today? And what about religion and spiritual intrigues that could bring them at least to be aware of what religion has historically meant and what it means to many people in the world today?
As I said actually earlier, and a lot of my waking up millennial friends are very anti-religion because, of course, they see the religions foundering in tribalism and fundamentalism. But they are also becoming very aware of the distinction that is extremely important between religions and mysticism. So it's amazing, and this is, of course, why Adam has been so successful and why the new monastic order is thriving. There are millennials who truly want direct mystical connection with reality, because they know that if they don't have direct connection, they're simply not going to be able to take on the chaos that they've been born into. And these millennials are prepared to do serious, simple forms of prayer and meditation and mantra practice, which are the forms that I've discovered and other teachers have discovered can initiate anyone into a deep connection, whatever your path. What's needed in the world at the moment is what I've been trying to provide in my own work, along with many others, and that is a vision of the essential path, an essential map, the essential practices that can help you, drawn from the major traditions, and a very simple instruction as to how to practice to bring your heart, mind, soul, and body into alignment with reality. And I find that when I go out and I speak simply and from the depths of my experience and with no flaw, flaw, flaw to millennials like that, they really get the need for training, for discipline, and for the training of the mind and the heart that are truly essential for mystical passion, because they are hungry. They're hungry. And they know they can't find that passion in the institutional religions. They know they can't find it in the Oprah-selected teachers who just are selling popcorn, which they despise. But they do have a very profound shit detector, these millennials, and they do know when they're being talked to by someone who has been through the rigors and ordeals that you need to go through to tell the truth about the spiritual path and its terrible ordeals, but it's also its great revelations. So what they need, I find, is honest teachers and people like you and myself, Gary, who are trying to be as naked and as authentic and as honest as possible without giving up the beauty that we know to be truly helpful, the beauty of culture, the beauty of attuning the soul, the beauty of living in the spirit, the beauty of truly dedicating yourself to a sacred cause, the beauty of loving animals and nature with a devotional love. And when you model this nakedly without pretense to millennials, they really do catch fire, but we need more adults prepared to be naked with them and to be open and to be, and to acknowledge the depth of the situation and to not only to speak about their spirituality, but to live it in such a way that they inspire the young.
Andrew, thank you for being with us today. We appreciate it.
I appreciate you so much, Gary. Thank you. God bless you.
All right. Andrew Harvey from the Ozark Mountains. And by the way, just as a little aside, Andrew Harvey was the youngest professor in the history of Oxford University. And when he meant naked, he was referring to open and transparent. I want to thank you all for listening. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We take on one theme, generally with one or two people for the whole hour, so we can give it some depth. Hope you enjoyed it. Have a nice day, everyone.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find